It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, Baltimore erupted in violence yesterday after the funeral of Freddie Gray, a man who died from spinal injuries after being in police custody. We'll talk to a Baltimore Public Radio reporter about the latest news from the city. Yesterday was the funeral of Freddie Gray, a 25-year-old African-American man who died from a spinal injury after being in police custody.
Riots followed in the afternoon. More than a dozen police officers were injured, over 200 people arrested. The majority of those people were under the age of 30.
Maryland Governor Larry Hogan declared a state of emergency last night, and Baltimore City Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake has imposed a curfew from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m. Baltimore City schools were closed today.
The state deployed hundreds of National Guard members to the city, and the city government has requested 5,000 law enforcement officers from around the region to help.
We have Kenneth Burns with us now. He's a reporter for WYPR, Baltimore's public radio station. Kenneth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
And we're going to start by hearing from Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake yesterday. Here's how she framed the riots.
I'm a lifelong resident of Baltimore. And too many people have spent generations building up this city for it to be destroyed by thugs who, in a very senseless way, are trying to tear down what so many have fought for.
The mayor of Baltimore speaking yesterday, is that still the narrative? Is that how the riots are being seen today, the day after?
Well, the mayor has softened her tone. She had a press conference earlier this afternoon to announce that about 70 people from Teach for America, they'll be volunteering while they're not able to teach because schools are closed. But they'll be volunteering to feed students and talk with them, make sure they're okay, and show some care to the students. She said that there are no thugs in Baltimore, but that there are people who are broken, abused, and hurt, and they need help.
Now, news reports from yesterday say there were rumors of violence on Monday morning when the word purge started appearing on social media. It sounds like the police got a lead on that. What happened?
Well, that came out during the funeral for Freddie Gray. Baltimore police sent out an email saying that they've received credible information as far as a threat towards law enforcement officers. A pact between several gangs, including the Blood Crips and Black Gorilla Family, they have agreed to take out law enforcement officers over Freddie Gray. Now, since last night, various gang members have came out and said, that's not true. There is no pact. That is not what we stand for. We don't want any violence over the Freddie Gray case.
So what do we know about who was responsible for the violence yesterday?
The majority are younger than 30, as you read in your intro. Mostly high school students around that age. And there was another report that the gathering was called via social media. There's a high school near where the riot really started to take place, near the Mondawmin Mall, which is also close to the church where the funeral services for Freddie Gray took place.
Now, there are reports of something like 15 police officers being injured. What were those interactions like yesterday between the police officers and those who were rioting?
Well, there wasn't much interaction between the officers and the rioters. In fact, when police arrived to the scene, the crowd dispersed and they scattered many directions. The violence traveled south from the mall to with the CVS that was first looted, then it was set on fire. That was the most known image around from yesterday's riots.
And there was some nonviolent response as well to the death of Freddie Gray. There was earlier nonviolent demonstrations. There were also volunteers cleaning burn buildings, clergy members. What has that end of the response been like?
Well, it was peaceful up until this past Saturday evening. That's when you had the response. That's where you had the violence really come out. Sunday, there was no violence, but Monday, the day of the funeral, after the funeral, that's when the violence escalated. as far as that could play. It's been ebb and flow. But during the riot, there was a group of clergy. They locked arms. They walked down North Avenue praying and trying to keep peace in the community. And you've also had, there's also been stories of people in the community standing in harm's way, really, between the police officers and the people who really went to wreak havoc.
Now, there is a curfew in place in Baltimore. There is the National Guard called in. What is expected tonight?
That's the big question. It has been, this is the first memory that Baltimore has had a curfew like this. It's the first time since 1968 that the Maryland National Guard was called to Baltimore to keep the peace. So that's the main question. Will there be peace in Baltimore tonight? Will there be protests to even try to break the curfew? There is a lot of uncertainty right now that no one really has the answer to.
Kenneth, thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
That was Kenneth Burns, reporter for WYPR, Baltimore's public radio station. He was here with the latest on riots and the response in Baltimore. We're continuing our coverage of the Baltimore riots yesterday. The violence started in the afternoon after the funeral of Freddie Gray. Gray was an African-American man who died after suffering a spinal injury in police custody.
Maryland Governor Larry Hogan has declared a state of emergency and asked for law enforcement help from surrounding states. Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake has put a mandatory curfew in place from 10 p.m. to 5 a.m.
We just spoke with a reporter from Baltimore Public Radio, WYPR. Now we turn to Dan Diamond. He's a contributor for Forbes and editor of the Advisory Board's Daily Briefing, a healthcare newsletter. He grew up in Baltimore and has been following the events there. He wrote a piece called Why Baltimore Burned. Dan, welcome to Central Time.
Veronica, thank you for having me.
Well, what was your first reaction when you heard that there were riots in Baltimore following Freddie Gray's funeral?
Well, on the one hand, it was kind of a sad reaction of not being surprised. We have come to expect some civil unrest after various tragedies that have happened in these past number of months. What also happened was I was on a flight back from California to the East Coast, and I was sitting next to really one of the nation's leading public health experts. We were talking on background, so I don't want to say who it was. But the two of us ended up getting into a longer conversation, me as a health reporter, this person as an expert, on what were the underlying reasons behind this sort of reaction in Baltimore. Where was this anger coming from? How much of it was because of the structural inequality in the city? And that got me thinking about my feelings and thoughts here, and that led to the story that you mentioned.
And that conversation that you mentioned, one way to capture it is your point of view that there are really two Baltimores. What do you mean by that?
So that's right. I guess I played off the Dickens line of two cities, except in Baltimore's case, they're the two cities in the one city. There's an anecdote that I think explains Baltimore really well, something that you only know if you've lived there. And I spent 20 years there. My parents still live there. I go back a lot. And in Baltimore, when you go out to dinner with someone, they ask you where you went to school. And they don't mean a college like Madison or Indiana. They want to know what local private school in Baltimore you went to, what private high school. And that's because many public schools in Baltimore are so underfunded that families with any money, they try and send their kids to private school. And I don't think that that's typical across the country. I can't say I know Wisconsin all that well. But that's the Baltimore I knew. That's the world I lived in. On the other hand, you know, really not very far from where I grew up, just a couple miles, there was another Baltimore. And that part of the city, there were 40%, 50% of households living under the poverty level, which is about $12,000 a person, or, you know, a household of four, that's $24,000, not a lot to live on. I did volunteer work. I interned at the Baltimore Sun. I spent a lot of time in those communities, and it was striking how little help, how few tools and strategies kids my age in those communities had to draw on if they were looking to build their lives in a different direction to get out of those neighborhoods.
Now, President Obama weighed in on this yesterday, talking about how the nation needs to look for longer-term solutions. Here's what he had to say.
But I think we as a country have to do some soul-searching. If we think that we're just going to send the police to do the dirty work of containing the problems that arise there without, as a nation and as a society, saying what can we do to change those communities to help lift up those communities and give those kids opportunity, then we're not going to solve this problem.
And Dan, that gets at what you were referring to earlier, you and your seatmate, public health expert at a national level, talking about some structural inequalities. You came up with a list of things that needed to be addressed. What did you come up with?
Sure, Veronica, and I think the president was getting to some of this, that you need to have safe housing in these communities. Do you have programs to train folks to help them to acquire job skills? Do you have the proper food and nutrition, especially for kids who are developing? And in a place like Baltimore, and I bet in, you know, a big city like Milwaukee too, there are these areas of what we call food deserts where there really is no fresh produce. Locals end up going to a fast food place or 7-Eleven to get what they need to eat. And is there a stable community in Baltimore, in the neighborhood where Freddie Gray was living? About 1 in 3 homes sits vacant. That's, you know, staggering to think about. And in a city like Baltimore, where there has been so much traffic, so much flight to the suburbs, that just leaves behind the folks who can't leave. And I know that Baltimore specifically has tried all kinds of different tactics to get people to come back in to the city, various homeowner purchase discounts and trying to lure businesses back in too. But for a variety of reasons, it just hasn't worked over the past couple decades.
As people from different communities in Baltimore look at what happened yesterday, what could happen tonight, and try to put all of it in context, it looks as though people are looking back quite a ways. How far would you say that some of these issues you're talking about, how far back do they go?
Oh, I have to say 40 or 50 years. I mean, Baltimore infamously had a much worse riot in the 1960s, I think 1968 off the top of my head, and these were issues back then too. So nothing new. You know, this crisis didn't emerge just this week. These were tensions that have simmered and festered, and no one in Baltimore has known what to do about them. And they broke open with the Freddie Gray tragedy. I would actually add one thing, though. Baltimore, to me, is not exceptional in the sense that these issues are across the country in any big city where you find massive inequality between the well-off and those who are less well-off. I think Milwaukee has probably similarities to Baltimore in that sense. And that is, as a health reporter and someone who tracks policy issues around the country, that concerns me, that we overlook this inequality until we're forced to confront it.
Dan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Veronica.
We've been talking to Dan Diamond, contributor for Forbes and editor of the Advisory Board's Daily Briefing, a healthcare newsletter. He grew up in Baltimore, and he joined us to talk about his piece, Why Baltimore Burned.
When it comes to broadband access and cell service in northern Wisconsin, there are some pretty big gaps. According to our next guest, that's one of the biggest problems facing that part of our state.
She says investments are needed to beef up the infrastructure and networks and makes the case that the region's economy and safety are at stake.
Joining us now is Janet Bewley. She's a Democratic state senator from Ashland. Senator Bewley, thanks for joining us.
It is my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So as it stands right now, what is the status? What is broadband access like in your part of the state?
It is very inconsistent. And it's not just broadband access. It's something as simple as making a cell phone call. Sometimes we've got people who can send a text, but they can't take a cell phone. They've got low broadband speeds or they've got no broadband connection at all. We've got people that are still using dial-up and they're a couple miles away from people who have fiber. It's very inconsistent and it's therefore very difficult to sell the North to other parts of the state, to other people who may want to live here, that we are as connected as the rest of the state when it comes to communication.
So I guess the big question is why? Why haven't those things, the broadband access, internet speeds, cell connections kept up in northern Wisconsin with the rest of the state?
Well, I think it's because we have had varying degrees of laws that require the providers to do certain things over time. So you start off with a pretty good network of telephone hard lines. But then you've got new things coming in. Internet connectivity was done different kinds of ways with different sorts of wire providing that. And then on top of that now, you've got cell phones and smartphones that need all kinds of different technologies. And those installations are being driven not by the public good, as was done originally with electricity and telephone, but by profit. So those investments are only made when there is a guaranteed market.
At first glance, people might say, okay, you've got slower internet. It takes longer to download the cat videos. Words with Friends is slower. In a recent opinion piece, you say, no, this is a big deal for the economy of your region. Why is that?
Absolutely. If you wanted to come to the north and expect to have a business, or you're going to bring your family and they're going to live and move there and they're going to enjoy what they may have had when they lived in Eau Claire, you can't make those assumptions about the north. We aren't able to say, well, if you want to move to where I live right now in Delta outside of Ashland, that you can expect to make a telephone call wherever you want to. We can't do that. And what's even worse is that there might be the opportunity very soon where the telephone providers may be able to let go of their landlines. And letting go of landlines in some rural areas mean they will have no way to connect with the outside world. Literally, no way to connect with the outside world. And that is not only economically uncomfortable, it's just downright dangerous.
Talking to State Senator Janet Bewley from Ashland, talking about gaps in broadband service and cell coverage, slow internet speeds. Says it's bad for the economy of the region, and not just the economy. You say this is a safety issue, and this has come up for you personally. Can you tell that story?
Oh, absolutely. My husband was experiencing chest pains at a time that we had a power outage. Now, a power outage may seem like something that happens, infrequently, but it happened. And when it did happen, I did not have cell coverage because of where we live. My cell phone does not work. And with a power outage, our telephone line, our landline, did not work. So there was no way, if I needed to, for me to call 911. So instead, I had to drive to the closest location where I knew I could make a cell phone, and I called the hospital. They told me to bring my husband in immediately, which I did by car, and then he was taken to Duluth where he had surgery, and he's now perfectly fine. But I think of those people who may right now be living in a home where they have a landline. And what would they do if their landline was taken away and they can't get cell phone coverage? I mean, would you tell somebody who may have been living in a farmhouse for the last 50 years that you have to now move? Or would you tell them, well, I guess you're going to have to suck it up and hope you don't have to call for emergency in case your house catches on fire? These are serious things that are in rural areas, and I want to make sure that people can feel just as connected and just as safe in their homes if they're living in Ashland County or if they're living in Dane County.
So what are you looking for? What would need to change? What would the state have to do to start tackling these problems?
Well, first of all, the state would have to have a kind of a shift in thinking, that, and the thinking would have to be directed towards investing in the public good. I mean, just plain saying, we need to bring the rural area up to 21st century standards, and we're willing to pay for it. And that would be to provide some of the infrastructure, or at least the incentive to businesses to build the infrastructure, so that we could have cell phone towers where we need them, so that we could have broadband as competitive and as fast as other parts of the state. If the state believed in it and wanted to do it, it could be done.
Tough budget times right now. Even there might be legislators, your colleagues, who might say, yeah, this is important, but we've got so many other things on the table right now, so many cuts to education we'd want to fill. Does this issue, does broadband in northern Wisconsin rise to the top and need, deserve funding in tough budget times?
I think it does. I think it does, because I think that we have got to make sure that we don't let investments like these slip away, and so that 20 years from now we're still behind the times. Because by that time, we would have found that more and more people are going to leave the rural areas, and they're going to move where they can get connected. I don't want that to happen. We have an aging population in the north. They need to be connected. We have counties in the north that have 10% unemployment rates. And it will not get better unless we can say we are competitive with the communication networks in other parts of the state. This is an absolute necessity to invest in the north.
I'm going to bring in a caller now. We've got Lynn on the line in Coloma. Lynn, hi.
Hi, I'm in Washira County, and we are in a glacial kind of a situation where we're in a glacial kind of a scoop. And I have to run to the end of the driveway to use my iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
We do not have a landline,
mm-hmm.
and we have no internet connection. And I get three radio stations, and now they're talking about taking away WPR. So that means I get a choice of a Christian station out of Toma, and I get a choice of a Catholic Hour station nearby.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand why this is, and I'm an hour north of Madison.
Right.
I am not in northern Wisconsin.
Thanks, Lynn, for the call. Senator Bewley, not just in your neck of the woods up north, well south of there, other gaps, Lynn is saying, in internet and cell coverage.
Well, I think that that absolutely has to be covered. I mean, if you take a look at what it is we want to make sure we can do when we provide fire coverage, we know every single fire number in the state and where, what, which department would respond. We've been able to do that. But we aren't able to say, and when you call to report your fire number, you're going to be able to make a call. Now, to me, it means that on one hand, we want to identify you and we want to make sure the fire department knows where to go, but we are not going to invest in your capacity to make that call. And I think that no one is saying pay for your telephone bill. No one is saying that the state should pay for all of it. But the state should play its part in making sure that that caller can feel safe in her own home and know that she can make a call. Because if the companies are going to not only not invest, but indeed pull out a landline, we're going to be making the problem worse rather than better.
You contrast in that piece you wrote northern Wisconsin with what's going on in northeastern Minnesota. What are they doing on that side of the border?
Well, northeastern Minnesota has been trying very hard for a number of years to make sure that tax income that comes into the state because of the mining efforts up there is continually reinvested in the local area and not in things that are directly related to mining. They invest in things like utilities and broadband expansion. They invest directly in their schools, and they invest in ways that have the money that goes through the state be returned in an equitable manner to the parts of the state that need it the most. Now, in Wisconsin, we are pulling away from making purposeful investments in the parts of the state that need it, and rather we are looking at ways to cut taxes for companies that don't. And I think that that's just, it's a matter of political will. It's a matter of orientation to what is the public good and what should be government be doing. And I think government should be doing more.
Could you put a price tag on this? What kind of funding level are you looking for to try to address this gap in internet and cell coverage in northern Wisconsin?
If we could come up with a couple million dollars for starts, I would say if we could come up with $10 million to start to incentivize companies to both put up the towers and make sure that they have the coverage for cell phones and digital as well, and then to work with the broadband providers to put in the fiber and the high-speed optics that we need in order to get them. Again, I'm not expecting the government to foot the entire bill, but I do believe we need to have money to leverage and to be able to incentivize the companies to make the investments themselves.
Are you hearing any sympathetic voices among your fellow legislators, especially the majority Republicans?
Well, they're kind of quiet about things like investing in rural areas right now. They have a lot to defend in other parts of the budget because we are not only seeing this issue sort of overlooked, but in fact, transportation investments into the rural parts of the state, investments in education, K-12, four-year-old kindergarten, those sorts of things are not being invested in the rural areas in a way that makes it fair and possible. And so a plea to help us with broadband is, it's not really, I don't want to say it's falling on deaf ears, but they're not listening very, very well.
Apart from partisan differences, briefly, do you think that northern Wisconsin is neglected by legislatures over the years of either party just because it's far away from Madison?
Well, I think that, you know, it's always far away. And so, you know, we're not getting any closer to Madison as the years go by. So any legislator always has to work very, very hard to make sure that, not that we're needier than most, but that we are different and that there you can't have assumptions about our ability to make a phone call the way you can about in another part of the state. Is it different now? It is different now because, again, the role of government is being revised by those who are in power now into a smaller government that does not make investments in the far reaches of the state. And rather, they are trying to reduce what government does, particularly when it comes to the tax burden.
Senator Bewley, thanks for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
That's Janet Bewley, Democratic State Senator from Ashland, joining us to make the case for expanding broadband and cell access in northern Wisconsin.